This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. If you want a tip on a great thriller, you could do a lot worse than follow the advice of Stephen King. In a New York Times review, he raved about a book called The Witch Elm, the most recent mystery novel by the writer Tana French. French has been called the queen of Irish crime fiction, although she herself is originally American, and she's often called a mystery writer for people who don't really read mysteries. Maybe that sounds like some kind of faint praise, but make no mistake, fans of Tana French are almost crazily devoted to her books, and that certainly describes The New Yorker's Alexandra Schwartz.
Tana, I need to begin with a confession. I have to ration your books because once I start one, I'm totally lost to the world. I have to be careful about when I choose to read one, because if I have anything else going on at that moment in my life, I'm just not going to be able to do it.
Thank you so much. I like being a bad influence.
But you didn't start writing until you were in your 30s, which, you know, might seem to some readers relatively late. And before that, you were an actor. And I was wondering how that change came about.
To be honest, it was sort of always on the cards. I used to write when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, but, you know, we're talking short stories and your basic really terrible teenage poetry. But the acting sort of took over. I was doing theater, and unless you're Judi Dench or somebody, the gigs don't line up right. So there's always a gap in between. And in one gap, I did a few weeks on an archaeological dig, and there was a wood not far from the dig. And I was looking at it and thinking, God, that would be a great place for kids to play. And then I thought, what if three kids ran in there and only one came out and he had no memory of what had happened to the other two? And then what if he became a detective and a case drew him back to that wood? And I really wanted to know what would happen with that story. And I didn't think I could write a whole book. I'd never tried before. But I figured I could probably write maybe a scene and then another scene. And then I had a whole chapter. The moment when I found myself turning down acting work, I think that was when I realized that I was really, really serious about this book. And from there on, it sort of all followed.
And that book was In the Woods, which was published in 2007.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's to write a thriller or a crime novel or mystery. And I wonder, actually, if there's a term that you prefer for your own books. It takes a lot of intricate plotting. You have to lead your reader on a bunch of twists and turns. How did you manage to figure out that plotting for that very first book?
Oh, plotting is not my strong point. I'm pretty at home with characterization because, you know, acting is really good training for that. And I'm at home with the actual sentence-to-sentence writing. But structure is the part that I've put a lot of work into getting right. It's not a part that comes naturally to me. But also, I'm lucky. My husband is an actor as well, and he directs short films. And he has like a demon eye for structure, right? Because he's watched every old film in the universe. And so he's very good on structure. So he reads for me and he'll go, okay, hang on a second. That is not fitting together structurally. That subplot has got lost, or you're not moving that scene forward enough. But I think in some ways, mystery was actually a very good way to learn that because it's got such a built-in arc. You know, A kills B and then C finds out who done it. So that keeps you on track to some extent. I think if I'd been writing something like straight literary fiction, it would have been much easier to just keep on writing forever and never stop, whereas at least mystery has a clean arc that you have to stick to.
I'm wondering about the language and the psychology of detective work, because there's so, your books are dense with that. The partner dynamic is to me such a satisfying part of reading one of your books, that kind of back and forth that goes on between partners. And Rob and Cassie in the Woods embody this to a T. And I was wondering if you could read, you have a passage where Rob describes feeling this way. And I was wondering if you could read it.
Yeah, absolutely. The girls I dream of are the gentle ones, wistful by high windows or singing sweet old songs at a piano, long hair drifting, tender as apple blossom. But a girl who goes into battle beside you and keeps your back is a different thing, a thing to make you shiver. Think of the first time you slept with someone, or the first time you fell in love, that blinding explosion that left you crackling to the fingertips with electricity, initiated and transformed. I tell you that was nothing, nothing at all, beside the power of putting your lives, simply and daily, into each other's hands.
How did you learn the vernacular of detective work in order to write these books?
Well, I'm lucky. I know a retired detective who is a really lovely guy, and he's also a serious talker, right? So all you have to do is press play, buy him a nice cup of coffee, say, talk to me, and he'll just keep talking till the coffee runs out. He has been so generous with his time, and that's where I'm getting the flavour of these little things, the dynamics. To an extent, the partner relationship, that's something that's always fascinated me as well, because I love, which is going to sound weird for a writer who works alone, but I love working with people. One of the things I miss most from acting is the teamwork of it. When you're doing a scene with somebody and it's a difficult scene and it's one that you know can be amazing if you get it right, and you're working with somebody where you're really attuned to each other and you can throw anything at them and know they'll bounce it back to you with something more added, it's an amazing feeling. It's one of the real joys of acting. And I was thinking about detectives and going, what would it be like to have that relationship where you are so tuned into each other that you're working practically as one and have it be life and death and truth and justice on the line? I think that must be, when it works, an incredible thing.
Your books are set in Dublin, and you are not originally from Dublin. When did you come to Dublin? What was it about the city that fascinated you or that drew you in?
Yeah, I'm an international brat. I think the official term is third culture kid, isn't it? But I grew up moving around. My parents are from several continents between them. And when I went to college, it just seemed like the natural place to go. It was the place I knew best. So yeah, this seemed like the natural place to be. I'm here since 1990.
Since 1990. So you were here, or there rather, during the Celtic Tiger, which is something that comes through in all of your books, the period of astonishing growth in Ireland that transformed Ireland from a relatively poor country into a rich one, and then came crashing down with the international crash in 2008. What was that like to live through?
That was very strange to live through, and in particular from the point of view of a broke actor who wasn't actually participating in the Celtic Tiger in any way. We were constantly being told by the government, by the media, by everyone around us during the Celtic Tiger that what was happening was wonderful. But from our perspective, this just meant I have no chance of ever buying a house and my rent is skyrocketing. And then when it all came crashing down, the people who suffered the most psychologically weren't the people like me who had been outside it anyway. I mean, I couldn't have afforded a shed in the middle of nowhere during the Celtic Tiger. But the people who were hurt worst were the people who had believed in this narrative implicitly and thrown themselves into it, who had bought those apartments off the plans, bought the houses built on floodplains because they believed that, you know, in 5 years you'll be able to sell it for triple the price to another sucker and you'll all live happily ever after. And I think that for those of us who hadn't been playing by the rules anyway, it was less devastating, but we still saw that devastation. And my generation is the one that got kicked particularly hard. So yeah, it seeps through into the books. It really does.
Yeah, and you're basically describing a victimization narrative where en masse people are led to, they're given a bait and switch. They're led to believe one thing and it turns out that the truth is something very different. And that's something that comes back in such a fascinating and rich way in novel after novel of yours. And, you know, I think we should say, especially for people who haven't read these books, the detectives are all pretty damaged people. They are not the most reliable narrators, even when they believe themselves to be. Yep. Often there are memory issues, which you use to, you know, manipulate the information around them. They either remember things that didn't happen or have memory problems. Why are you drawn to that kind of detective? Because, you know, many mystery writers like to create a sort of figure of authority who is going through a twisted, shadowy world, but yeah. is ultimately going to bring truth to light. And even when the truth comes to light in your books, it may not be the whole truth, and it may not matter for practical purposes whether the truth is outed at all.
Yeah, it doesn't always reimpose order. I'm fascinated by unreliable narrators because, okay, I think that one of the core points of the arts is to give us an insight into a glimpse of what it's like to be someone else, to see the world for a little while through someone else's eyes and to realize that other people have viewpoints that are completely different from our own and that those are just as real and intense and vivid and valid. And this is going to sound odd, but I think an unreliable narrator does that best because we are all unreliable narrators of our own lives. We all do reshape our own narratives to make them fit what we want to believe or what we need or just what interests us most. Like if you've got siblings, right, and the two of you tell a story about some argument that happened in your childhood, you're going to get two completely different versions of that argument because both of you have shaped the narrative to fit what suits your thoughts best. And if you're reading an unreliable narrator, that's what brings you closest to the person because you're not seeing their experience objectively. You're seeing it the way they see it, which is through their thoughts, through their biases, through their needs and their fears and their desires. So I think an unreliable narrator is the one you know most intimately, ironically, and the one who comes closest to fulfilling what the arts are really for.
Well, it's funny what you say about siblings. I'm an only child, so I'm sitting here thinking, yeah, but I know what really happened. You know, I have the only story. And it occurs to me that Toby, the narrator of The Witch Elm, is also an only child and has definitely a touch of that same narrative arrogance. So how did you decide? The Witch Elm is the only one of your books thus far not to be narrated by a detective or not to take place from that point of view. How did you decide to flip that framework?
Well, for one thing, I wanted to move away from the Dublin Murder Squad a bit because I don't ever want to get caught in the trap of writing the same book over and over. And I think if you're writing in a specific procedural subgenre where it is A kills B and the detective finds out through investigation who done it, it's quite easy to fall into that trap. So I thought I wanted to take a step back. And I'd looked at the process of investigation from a detective's viewpoint 6 times, and I kept thinking about the other viewpoints involved. Like in that same investigation, you've got witnesses, you've got victims, you've got suspects, you've got perpetrators, and all of them have to see that investigation entirely differently. But for all those other people, it's a totally different thing. It's this force that just barrels into your life, turns everything upside down. You have no idea where you stand in it. Are you a witness? Are you a suspect? What are you? You have no idea why the detectives are doing what you do. You have no idea where it's going to go, how much destruction it's going to cause, where it's going to stop. And I thought all of those viewpoints deserved a look in as well, deserved a voice too. And at different points in the book, Toby's all of those. He's victim, witness, suspect, perpetrator. To an extent, detective as well. So he kind of covers all the bases. I wanted to try out those different viewpoints.
This novel is quite capacious, and a lot of critics have noticed this about... To me, that's a good thing, by the way.
There's a lot of it, I know.
And you do this in a lot of your books, in all of your books, but in this one in particular, there's a lot of time spent with your character where nothing seems to be happening from the perspective of figuring out who did the crime or even what the crime is. You know, what kind of purpose does that serve for you? Another way to put it is you're often referred to as a literary crime writer, which is, you know, I don't know how you take that term, if it's flattering or condescending or what, but I think people mean the writing is beautiful, there's this kind of exquisite characterization. What do you make of that literary, quote-unquote, side of things?
It's hard because I think the boundaries in fiction are breaking down all the time, which is a great thing. You know, they bleed over from what used to be considered, this is what literary fiction should be like, this is what crime fiction should be like. More and more, there's a lot of crossover. See, for me, I don't know what I'm writing. I'm just writing this book. And the core story arc is not the murder and the solution. The core story arc is Toby. Is Toby going from this golden boy in his happy life to somebody who's had that shattered and what he does about it? How will he put the pieces back together? Will he be able to? Where will this crisis take him? That's the story arc. I think, it's going to be... It's going to be frustrating for some people, because if you're coming to the book expecting a straight up crime novel that abides by the genre conventions in which, the core of the book is the murder investigation, then you are going to be going about 100 pages in, where's my murder? Where's this investigation? So, I can see where if there's a clash between the expectations and the actual book, that always gets frustrating. But I like the fact that those expectations are no longer the be-all and end-all, that for more and more crime writers, you don't have to stick to the conventions. You can use them as a starting point rather than a finishing point.
I have to ask you, there are two mysteries in the woods. There's the mystery of what happened to Rob when he was a child. He was one of those three children who you originally imagined who go into the woods and only one comes out. That one is him, and he has no memory of what happened. And then there's the actual murder that he's trying to solve, which takes place in a similar wood. And I won't say which on radio, of course, but we find out the answer to one of those mysteries and not both. Do you know what happened in the other mystery? Is that something in your mind, or are you just leaving it open for yourself as well?
No, I know more or less. I don't know every specific, but I know the general, what happened. But there was kind of no way with integrity to work it into the book. So I kind of went, okay, there are going to be some readers who aren't happy. And fair enough. I can see why. But I'm going to have to stick with the one that makes it as good a book as possible. Keep my fingers crossed that there are enough people who think like me. So I went with that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely respect your decision and appreciate it. And at the same time, I'm so desperate to know what happened and went on, various message boards with outlandish theories.
Oh, seriously, are there?
And so they're out there. They're out there for sure. I just wanted to know. But I also know I will have to live with my own state of ignorance. It's just part of life. Tana French, thank you so much.
Thank you. That was great.
Tana French's most recent novel is The Witch Elm, which is just coming out in paperback. And Alexandra Schwartz is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and she covers books and theater and a lot more. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This week, my colleagues here at the New Yorker are telling us about the books they're most excited to read this summer. And Doreen St. Felix writes about, well, she writes about a lot of things, including pop culture. Doreen, what book's on your mind lately?
A debut novel called Famous People by Justin Karitzkis.
And what's it about?
So Famous People is a fake memoir about a fake pop star.
I'm liking it already.
So it's basically written as a stream of consciousness first draft of a memoir of this unnamed 22-year-old who has been famous since he was 12 years old. And he's a really, he's kind of a heartbreaking narrator, this kid, because, you know, he's famous, he hasn't experienced the real world, and yet he's so desperate to understand what it is about him that his fans love so much. And he's totally naive. He doesn't understand what it is to be a normal person in the world because, you know, since he was a child, 12 years old, he's been pushed into the limelight. But he's starting to very slowly and then increasingly more profoundly as the book goes on, he's starting to realize how fame affects the people around him.
People are so mad at each other. People are taking life so seriously. People are losing hope. And I think, honestly, it's because people are so rooted in their own particular spot in the universe. But something happens to you when you're touring all around the world all the time. Something happens to you when you visit some country you've never heard of and you see your face on the side of a bus being used to sell some soda that you didn't even know existed. And you call up your people and you're like, yo, did we agree to this? And they tell you, yes, it was part of an overall deal with East Asia. Something happens. You realize how fucking tiny you are.
And it's the debut novel by somebody named Justin Karitzkis.
Yes.
Who is that?
So Justin Karitzkis is a playwright, and I've known his plays for a really long time. The last play of his that I saw in Brooklyn was called Asshole.
Did the ceiling come down on us? I think we're okay.
He also is a niche YouTube celebrity. He makes these really strange but deeply brilliant videos in which he uses Photo Booth, you know, that editing application. And essentially what he does is he creates these little skits, and it's just him in front of his computer. He uses Photo Booth to manipulate his body so he's able to play two characters at once. And the skits are absurd. They are surrealist. They're really strange. They're not like the kinds of videos that we've known YouTube celebrities to actually get famous for.
Sounds great.
And in addition to that, now Justin is a musician. He has released an album called Songs About My Wife. It's in the tradition of being a parody of pop music, but also actually is good pop music on its own. So because Famous People is so much about the artifice of celebrity, I thought it would be bizarre, but also fun to talk to Justin at a temple of celebrity strangeness, which is Madame Tussauds, obviously, in Times Square, New York. Madame Tussauds is one of the busiest attractions in Times Square, so in order to beat the crowd, I asked Justin, who I know for a fact is a late sleeper, to meet me there at 8 a.m.
What's up?
How's it going?
Good, how are you?
So happy to be here.
So we almost had the place to ourselves.
Have you been to one of these before?
This is my first time at any wax museum.
How much did you look up about wax museums and Madame Tussauds?
Oh, very little, because okay. I wanted to be surprised. And
I didn't want to know anything about what we were actually going to see, but I couldn't help just go to the Wikipedia page for Madame Tussauds, and I found out that she was like a She was involved in the French Revolution.
Wow. What a monument to her important
She was
work.
A royalist sympathizer
wow.
in the French Revolution. And what she was doing was that she would go around and make wax figures of famous victims of the Reign of Terror and, like, display them around, being like, look at what's happening. The first, according to Wikipedia at least, the first one she ever did was Voltaire.
And then from that, of course, comes Marilyn Monroe, Frank
yeah,
Sinatra.
Yeah, right. And then it was straight to Gaga and all of that. But yeah, I had always assumed that it
so
was
So it's really easy to make a satire on the subject of celebrities. But famous people, it's not quite a satire. I think that famous people is a work of real empathy. It seeks to access the interior of a young celebrity's mind. There are people who were kind of running through my mind as I read the novel, including Billie Eilish, who's 17 years old, you know, some of the SoundCloud rappers, and even Justin Bieber.
Is that going to be your next book, Justin?
That is the next, yeah.
Oh, wow. Look who we have here.
First on the stop.
So we are currently in the New Year's Eve exhibit at Madame Tussauds, staring at a kind of dead-eyed effigy of Justin Bieber. Were you thinking about Bieber?
I mean, I don't think it's like... The character's certainly not a stand-in for Bieber, but, you know, Bieber's one of those people who you just can't avoid. Even if you didn't want to know anything about Justin Bieber, you're gonna know a lot about Justin Bieber. And I guess that sort of, like, ubiquity of somebody like this, and the fact that it's this guy, like, with this look on his face, that this is the person we all have to follow and know about, disturbed me and intrigued me and was sort of, I don't know, I was trying to find some meaning in that and why it's this guy.
Right. And you mentioned the look on Bieber's face, which is kind of shockingly despondent. This wax statue, depressed by the massive fame that he's reached at the age of, you know, 17 years old. What's so interesting about celebrity in this era is, like, there's no honesty, right? There's a lot of layers distancing us from the famous person, what it is that they actually think. But your famous person is actually writing a memoir.
There was a part of me that needed to believe that there was something more going on there with somebody like Bieber or Selena Gomez or whoever, Miley Cyrus. Like, I'm so intimately involved in these people's lives against my will. Yeah, I kind of wanted to write into being the character that I needed these people to be so that I could continue being invested in their lives through no choice of my own.
I know Justin is being a writer, but there are thousands of people online who really only know Justin through his YouTube videos and have actually kind of developed a cult following of him. There are people who think that Justin is the funniest person online.
You can't handle my strongest potions. No one can. My strongest potions are fit for a beast, let alone a man. Potion seller, what do I have to tell you to get your potions? Why won't you trust me with your strongest potions, potion seller? I need them if I'm to be successful in the battle. I can't give you my strongest potions because my strongest potions are only for the strongest beings and you are of the weakest.
So I think the fact that we're still talking about this video years and years after Justin uploaded it to the internet speaks to how popular it is. It has, I think, right now, 5 million views on YouTube. There are subreddits. There are wikis about it. There exists a kind of person who lives online where if you just mention two words, potion seller, to them, they know exactly what you're talking about. And they might even be a scholar of Justin.
But what do you think about the intensity of fan worship, you know, in this era? You're someone who has a bit of a fandom yourself.
Yeah, I sort of became accidentally famous. You know, on YouTube all of a sudden I had to reconcile my feelings about my YouTube channel with the fact that for as long as I live, probably the vast majority of people who know me at all are going to know me for these videos I make with Photo Booth. And so if I die tomorrow, my obituary is going to say YouTuber Justin Karitzkis, who also wrote a book, you know, who also wrote some plays. But mostly it's going to lead with potion seller dies. And I sort of quickly became really okay with that. Again, out of necessity, because it was just like, well, there's nothing you can do to change it. You know, like, I can try all I want to change that, but there's nothing I can do today that's going to change that.
I think that Madame Tussaud, people really ridicule it, right? It seems like a very silly thing to give your time, your attention, and your money to. But then you come face to face with some of these wax figures and you immediately understand why it is that people make this pilgrimage. I think of people like my mother, who is a very religious person and takes, you know, the statues that she has of religious figures, saints, like, very seriously. They're not relics, right? They don't contain any element or scrap of that person's physical form, but they are representations of the form. And I think that a lot of the people who are drawn to Madame Tussaud are people who think that even if, like, their rational brain is telling them differently, when they come across these statues, they do feel like they're making a connection.
Larry King is very realistic.
He's, like, slightly bent over in a Larry avuncular way. Anderson Cooper looking incredibly handsome, trim.
Yeah. He looks... Who's the... Oh, this is Madame Tussaud.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this is very meta, but it's a statue of her, and she's holding a bust of a very important-looking man's head, I'd say.
Yeah.
And what's... I mean, it's, like, kind of beautiful when you think about it.
It is really beautiful. Like, look at the pride she has.
In her work. I think, obviously, we are in the campiest place on Earth, but it's nice that people find ways to kind of, like, build monuments to individuals that mean something to them.
Totally. I think it's also, like, it's kind of emblematic of a lot of what we're talking about with pop and, like, the status of pop musicians as artists. Because, like, on the one hand, yes, this is, like, a multi, I'm assuming, billion-dollar tourist attraction that's all over the world. But in another sense, Madame Tussaud is one of the most successful artists of all time. Like, we're standing in a monument to this woman's art, like the art that she popularized an entire genre. And I don't think that's anything to shake a stick at. Like, she has a whole factory, you know, in the way that, like, the Renaissance guys would have, like, a whole factory of people making their work for them. Hers is ongoing. And, like, it looks like it's going to go on forever.
As long as we have celebrities.
As long as we have celebrities. And there's, like, different regional varieties of it, you know? Like, in Dubai, I'm sure they have celebrities that we don't know about.
Even though we got a baby, still got time to get crazy. When the baby's asleep, I'm a father, you're a mother, still got time to be loved.
The debut novel by Justin Karitzkis is called Famous People. And his pop album, because of course he has a pop album too, is called Songs About My Wife. He met up with Doreen St. Felix at Madame Tussaud's in New York. Now, if your idea of a beach read isn't a fake memoir by a fake pop star, but a big hardcover about a war or a biography of a president, you know, the kind of door stops that I'm talking about, I've got the guy for you. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he's also a historian and a professor of journalism at Columbia. So he's a pretty busy guy, and he has to choose his reading with care. So when the summer rolls around and you put books in your bag, either for the beach or you're now going to Australia for a long, you got a long flight ahead of you, do you take thick books of history, or is it where thrillers, or how does it work?
No, it's actually the opposite, because it's during the summer that I actually get to read seriously with history, to engage really with the literature that's come out, and you know, see where the field is going, mm-hmm. and things that I find interesting, and that during the year it's hard to keep track of.
So what are you going to be looking at this summer, or what should we be looking at this summer in the historical field?
Oh, there are lots of things, but there's a book that I have a bit of a conflict of interest in, because it was written by David Levering Lewis, who was my graduate advisor.
I think nobody's going to sue you for promoting a David Levering yeah, Lewis book.
No one will, I hope. Yeah. But it's a book about a Republican businessman who's tall and blue-eyed and has kind of rough-hewn manners, who comes out of nowhere and gets the Republican nomination for a presidency. Not the person that may come to mind immediately, yeah. but it's a biography of Wendell Willkie. And the thing that I found most compelling about this book was the portrait of the Republican Party in the middle part of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And there's some things that are familiar. There are the themes of resistance to business regulation and skepticism about foreign entanglements and international obligations. But there's a kind of improbable point at which people do something we wouldn't imagine now, and they think about things in the bigger picture and bipartisan relationships, and there's a kind of line that people don't want to cross in terms of the distinctions between the two parties. And after he loses to Franklin Roosevelt
and this is Roosevelt getting his third term, did Willkie have a good shot at winning?
So he doesn't wind up winning, but he does something after that, which is that he seems to legitimately be interested in seeing Roosevelt have a successful third term. Even going so far as to go on two separate envoy trips for the Roosevelt administration on the verge of the U.S. entry into the war. And we couldn't imagine something like that happening now. It's
no,
just
not
a completely
even close.
Different world.
Not even close. So David Levering Lewis's biography of Wendell Willkie. What else have you got coming?
Unexampled Courage. It's written by Judge Richard Gergel, whose name may be familiar to you in particular because you sent me to South Carolina to cover the trial of Dylann Roof. Judge Gergel presided over that trial. And it's a fascinating story on its face, but again, it also has a kind of bigger implication to it. It's a narrative about a black soldier by the name of Isaac Woodard, who is on his way back home from World War II. He's just been discharged, and he goes from the Philippines to South Carolina and gets into an argument with a bus driver and is thrown off the bus and arrested. And what happens after this is subject to dispute, but what's not in question is that a sheriff by the name of Linwood Shull hits him multiple times, and the result is that he loses his eyesight, permanently blind, and the injuries are much more extensive than what one might expect based upon what the reports are. Interestingly, this happens in 1946. The Truman administration gets very involved in this. He directs his Justice Department to look into this, and they wind up bringing charges against the sheriff. And there's a trial, which is presided over by a judge by the name of Wades Waring in Charleston, South Carolina. Judge Waring, who is not liberal on matters of race, looks at this case and is outraged at what happens. But nonetheless, a jury rules in favor of the sheriff. He's acquitted of the charges that are brought against him. And it seems to be a kind of regular Southern fait accompli.
But that's fascinating.
The aftermath is what becomes really interesting. It both sparks Judge Waring to move in a much more progressive direction in the bench, issuing rulings on civil rights that ultimately make him such a pariah that he leaves Charleston and lives out the rest of his life in New York.
You know, Jelani, you teach at Columbia, but it's okay that I think I see an Eric Foner title on the table. That's okay. It's all right. I'm Eric Foner, who's like the great historian of Reconstruction,
right,
and Civil War as well. Foner is not a kid. He's got a new book coming out.
He has a new book coming out.
And God bless.
It's called The Second Founding, and I got an advance copy of it in the mail and picked it up and found it to be really pertinent, really interesting for contemporary reasons. Eric Foner makes a compelling argument that the unresolved questions of the American Revolution that linger around and intensify and culminate in the Civil War aren't really resolved. And the idea of how we want to approach democracy, and specifically the question of how we think about citizenship, really takes the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to put into place. And my interest in this was specifically around the 14th Amendment and the conversations we're having now as it relates to immigration, as it relates to all of the kind
voting
of
slate rights.
Voting rights, all of this civil rights thing. And so I think it's a good summer read for people who are interested in having a kind of deep context for the conversations we're having right now.
So just before we leave, Jelani, just give us the list one more time so we can get the syllabus for our summer reading.
Okay, that's great. So I have Eric Foner, The Second Founding. I have David Levering Lewis, The Improbable Wendell Willkie. And I have Unexampled Courage.
There you've got it. The syllabus for the summer is set. Jelani, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. You can find all the books he mentioned at newyorkerradio.org. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today, my colleagues have been sharing some of their favorite books for the summer. And if you ask Gia Tolentino about her favorite book, she's likely to tell you about something that she first read when she was 9 years old. Gia was the kind of kid who read everywhere, on roller skates, on her bike, up a tree, and she still loves children's books no matter that she's pushing 30.
Hi, great to meet you, Rivka.
Gia, it's so good to meet you.
Recently, Gia went to talk about children's books with Rivka Galchin, who's interested in them as a novelist and as a teacher and as a parent.
Friendly. Sweet like
this. This is not so exactly beautiful. My local, but I come here. The only coffee shop that I like to work at is like down the street, and so I come here a lot when I'm stressed and spend like $400. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
that's good impulse spending.
They met up at a store called Books Are Magic in Brooklyn.
It's also like a good size, I feel, you know?
Yeah, no, it's curated.
It's curated.
You're not gonna
well.
Get lost.
Yeah. How old is your kid?
She's 5.
Cool.
Yeah. You grew up in Texas.
I grew up in Texas, yeah.
And I grew up in Oklahoma.
Oh, right.
So what was your bookstore when you were young?
I went to the library a lot. And when I was in like chapter book age, there was this really good used bookstore near me in the suburbs of Houston where you could buy books and then return them. So I would come
you
with like...
You pawn your books.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so I would just go there like every weekend with like a pile. What was yours like?
I had the least bookish childhood imaginable.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
No one in my house read. It was considered strange. The only books I would find at friends' houses. Like, that's where my books were like at other people's homes. I remember going to a garage sale, being really bored one summer. And they had a biography of Einstein. and Summer of My German Soldier, which is like a sexy affair book with the German soldier.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, the wrong, in good and bad ways, it was like nobody helping curate my reading.
Yeah, and did you like read all the Judy Blume books? Like, did you try to read all the...
I was like always afraid of puberty. I had like an early fear of it. So I remember reading them, but feeling like, in a weird way, that's when I was like, I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though it was the opposite, I was doing something right.
I know. Yeah. Where's the Judy Blume section? These chapter books are back here. Oh, yeah, they would be back here. Like, I secretly think, like, Newbery level books are like the best books that exist, you know? Like,
oh, no, I'm definitely on a page with you. I mean, this was my favorite book when I was little, The Phantom's Hole Booth.
That's the best
book. The perfect book ever.
That's like the best book. It's so good. This should win the Pulitzer Prize. It's so good. Like a perfect work of art. Love to get stoned and reread this book.
That holds up.
So good.
And what's interesting to me in that book.
Drawings. Oh my God.
Incredible. It's a perfect work of art. And one thing that surprised me is Milo is like, willful. Not only is his primary characteristic that he's bored all the time and everything bores him.
Yeah. But he's like easily depressed.
He's easily depressed. He's melancholy. And the only thing he has to do on this adventure is sort of wake up.
Yeah.
He's entering into adolescence. Yeah. Like, that's the way I see him now. Totally. Like, he's losing that special power he must have once had of finding the world interesting.
Oh, my God. Remember the part where, like, the, like, really synesthetic part where they play, like, the...
Oh, the symphony.
Yeah. They clap and then, like, a piece of paper appears or something. Like... Oh my God, it's so good. I like might buy a copy right now. I don't have a child, but I reread these books pretty often as partly as just like a reminder of what clear writing looks like. Economical, kind of pristine, very clear writing. All the Lewis Sacker books I still find like incredibly sophisticated. Like the Wayside School.
Holes I teach.
Holes is so good. Add this to my long list of children's books that I prefer to adult literature. Like,
it starts with this kid who's just everything is wrong in his life, and in every way his status is low and his family is not going to work out for him. And he's kind of like dispensed to this
work camp.
And
it has this iconic first line.
They don't know what they're digging for.
Yeah, it has this iconic first line. There's no lake at Camp Green Lake. And it becomes this, like, story about history and redemption and love.
And it's full of, like, as you said, it's like a masterclass in just storytelling.
Oh, the plotting of it is wild. It's like 150 years of plot. One of the things that makes me sad about these books is when they redo the covers. You know, like, have you...
Yeah, like, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Like, all of the Encyclopedia Brown books, it's not, like, cute line drawings. Let's see if we can find the Judy Blume ones. Like, the Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret cover, like, the new one... is like iMessage, you know, like she's literally texting, aww, like, and it's like, come on,
no.
You know, where are they? Oh, here they are. See, I bet
no,
you'll see
it. No, it's like this weird conservative streak that I have.
Yeah, like this
with
is like not
kids' tight. Books because you want it to be your childhood, not a new childhood.
Yeah, but you know, but even when we, like, I feel
like
that,
the old ones when you were young too.
Yeah, and even like the Harriet the Spy cover that I had was a line drawing from like the 60s or 70s, right? And it was still like those persisted well into the 90s, and then all of a sudden now, how
no,
best
it's a
to
beautiful
describe.
Color palette. I would buy whatever candy was wrapped in that.
Exactly, yeah. It looks like a candy bar, yeah. Right? Like, it's like, this was my favorite. Did you ever read this one, starring Sally J. Friedman as herself?
No.
Ooh, this one is good.
I love the Mysterious Benedict Society books.
I never read those.
I don't think, I didn't read them when I was little. I think if I looked on the dates, we couldn't have read them.
Yeah.
But I bought them as gifts for my niece and nephew.
They're good.
And I just think kids are waiting for a story that tells them that they have a special
power. Yeah.
And the weird thing is that I used to think, oh, how pathetic. They should know that you have to work hard to have special power.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, kids do have special powers. Their like noticing is very different. Their attention to detail is so different. I wonder sometimes if that's why there's so many detective books.
Right.
They have detective powers.
Here's an Anne of Green Gables here. I guess the Anne books do get, like, she gets old.
She gets old. She gets old. Jobs. She gets romance.
Did you ever read
she
the...
She plays Gilbert's.
I love. Did you love Gilbert?
I didn't. I thought
really?
He was boring.
Really? Yeah,
I thought he was
so boring.
Oh my god,
boring.
I loved Gilbert.
I actually feel like before puberty, the literature of female protagonists is quite incredible. There's
yeah.
Pippi Longstocking.
Everybody.
There's Anne of Green Gables. There's just so
there's like
many.
The West End Game. There's yeah. Like
now the
Wrinkle
Hilda series. I love
yeah.
Wrinkle. I just feel like it's overwhelming how many. And also the like boys are great. Like Pinocchio yeah. is amazing. And but I actually feel like if anything, I sometimes worry about young boys.
Yeah, I do too, because yeah. it's like men read a lot less than women, and childhood is the only time when everyone reads a lot. Yeah. And part of the reason, I think, is that the process of identification is so flexible in childhood. There are so many more, like in terms of gender at least, female protagonists that boys would identify with, like at the drop of a hat. A thing about Anne Shirley and a thing about like Laura Ingalls and Jo March and all the other bookish writerly heroines is they're also really headstrong. All of them have this desire to like work hard and like be good citizens in their little snow globe worlds, but they also all get into trouble all the time because they're extremely headstrong and make huge messes just by like clumsiness or just their natural tendency to cause trouble. And obviously, like, I related to that very strongly. Like both the desire to be kind of a hardworking little like happy busy bee and also to constantly be causing trouble, because that's what I was like as a kid. Yeah, I was like not completely well behaved, and so I related to these girls.
I also think for me anyways, something that was magical about those books, because I actually remember the mother across the street read us Little House on the Prairie out loud, and I mean, I remember so on Little House on the Prairie, they like roast the pig's tail and mm-hmm. eat it like a lollipop.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In the first book, I remember
yeah.
that one.
And they inflate the bladder and
yep.
make a balloon.
Like a balloon.
Out of it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it
yeah.
just seems like an incredible world. I also feel like a lot of these books are at least not for every kid, but I do think when you're a kid, you feel you have this like capacity for a greater adventure than you're having. These books sort of fulfill that dream of sort of something of the appropriate size to your heart occurring
yeah.
to you. Depending how the story is told, it's as if it finally calls upon yeah. all you have within you.
Well, right, because often, I mean, I often think like, yeah, being a kid, I mean, that's why like the summers are, you know, like you're so young, all you want to do is run around in the sun, and then you just have to be in school from like 8 a.m. till whatever, 4 p.m. And yeah, these books are like, what I really want to be doing is riding horses on the prairie, or like discovering I have a secret power, or like proving my bravery in a situation of great import, right? Like, it's like kids' books maybe admit that so much more than adult fiction, right? It's like what we really long for, you know, is really different than what our lives are.
Gia Tolentino and Rivka Galchin at Books Are Magic in Brooklyn. Gia's book Trick Mirror will be published in just about a week, so look out for it. I'm David Remnick. I hope you've enjoyed the show this week. Next week, Ben Taub joins us with the story of a man who was considered the most valuable prisoner in Guantanamo during the War on Terror. It's a fascinating story. Please join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Trent Williamson, Meng-Fei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.